Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. Today on the show, I'm speaking with Dave Kraft. Dave is director and co-founder of the Nuclear Energy Information Service, a safe energy anti-nuclear group based in Chicago. He co-founded NEIS with eight other activists in 1981 and has been doing energy work since 1979. Currently, he and NEIS are opposing a nuclear relapse, otherwise called nuclear renaissance by the nuclear industry, and supporting the carbon-free, nuclear-free energy policy approach for the US. Dave Kraft, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Yeah. And I congratulate you for sticking with it all these years, Dave.
And the same to you. We admire you very much for your perseverance.
Oh, well, and are you. Couldn't be more relevant. Now, let's start talking first about what that nuclear industry is up to in the United States. There have been various state moratoriums against any new nuclear power plants, and a nuclear power plant's sort of safe life is about 30 to 40 years. That's what they were designed for. So why don't you start covering what the insidious moves of the nuclear industry are at the moment in the U.S., Dave?
Sure. By way of a little bit of background for your listeners, the move to repeal the moratoriums that exist actually has its genesis in this so-called nuclear renaissance. I refer to it as a relapse, which you did in your introduction as well. It's one of those things of, you know, once burned, you know, twice wary. And I bring it up because this so-called nuclear renaissance actually had its official christening here in Chicago in December of 2001, the trade group for the industry, the Nuclear Energy Institute, had a big conference at a downtown hotel in Chicago, and I'm very pleased to say that members of NEIS and groups from Michigan, Don't Waste Michigan, did greet them at the hotel. Unfortunately, we weren't invited in. But the point was that the industry was down on its luck. It hadn't had any orders for decades. And in comes the Bush-Cheney administration with lots of promises and ideas that they would expand nuclear power. They also had a Republican-controlled Congress. So back then, it looked like a slam dunk for these guys that they would finally be able to get all this money and build new reactors again. It didn't work out for them over these last 8 to 10 years for a lot of reasons. But now there's actually been a shift. As you know, we have a new administration and a new Congress, and the industry is still at it, but it's more of a last gasp attitude at this point. If they can't pull it off now, then it could be that game is over for them. So one of the barriers that had remained to expanding nuclear power were the states that wisely enacted laws at the state level, which basically said, you can't build any more new nukes in our borders until you find a place to deal with the waste from the old nukes, the ones that have been built in previous decades and the ones that have been piling up over 50,000 metric tons of high-level radioactive waste with no place to go. And here, too, it's kind of relevant for Chicago, although it could certainly apply anywhere on the planet. I ask people, if they were to have built the Sears Tower or the World Trade Centers, or any of these large buildings years ago, without bathrooms, what do you think the reaction of people would have been?
That's a lovely analogy, Dave. I like that.
Yeah, it's exactly what the nuclear industry did, because they were building their present generation of reactors at the same time the Sears Tower and all these other buildings were going up.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's absolutely nonsensical that this industry got away with it, and now they're stuck with a bathroom problem. So the states were able to do this because they had local jurisdiction over how the plants got paid for. And if you couldn't figure out what the waste cost was, you couldn't have an accurate estimate of what the plants really were going to cost. So the Supreme Court of the United States let those laws stand at the state level. And this was a huge nuisance to the industry because prior to that, all of their victories were based on the fact that the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission had preemptive status over most of the activities of the industry. So this was a huge irritant to them, and they've been spending a good deal of the last 6 to 8 years trying to get these individual moratoriums repealed.
And so what's been the result to this point?
Well,
Dave
the result, I am pleased to say, were just announced at a press conference I was a part of just a few weeks back. Last year, 2009, the industry went 0 for 8 with one sort of questionable victory loss in the state of Minnesota. Most of the state moratoriums are still preserved. They are still standing. The legislatures seem to get it that, you know, this is a whole new energy climate we have now. The plants are no longer guaranteed to produce benefits for the states in which they reside because they're selling power into the grid now in a so-called deregulated market. And that means that the utilities that own these plants make out like bandits. They get all the profits and all of the contracts and all of that. And the people of the states where the reactors reside are going to end up with the liabilities, things like leaks, routine emissions, you know, below regulatory standards, and anything from having to pay the cost of tearing these plants down at the end of their useful lifetime, which you mentioned at the beginning of the show, to any other costs that may occur or accrue within the state boundaries because of these reactors. So it's a real double standard.
Yeah, let alone a meltdown.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
Yeah. How many states have the moratorium, Dave Kraft?
I believe the numbers in the low teens, somewhere around 13 or 14 states, have some sort of law which prohibits constructing new reactors.
Including California. But then you come from the state with the most number of nuclear reactors in a state in the United States. What, there are 12 or 13 reactors surrounding Chicago?
We have, in the state of Illinois, we have 14 reactors total. And 11 of those are operating and 3 are permanently closed for a variety of reasons. But if you take into account the near reactors on the other side of the lake from us on the west coast of Michigan, and a few of the reactors north of the border on the west coast of Lake Michigan in Wisconsin, then we actually have 17 reactors closer to Chicago than Chernobyl was to Kiev.
Oh my God.
So this is a very significant issue to us, particularly since we also have the world's, well, depending on the year, first or second busiest airport within less than 25 flight minutes to any of those reactors.
Oh, God. And then, of course, Obama hails from Chicago, and Obama received at least $250,000 from Exelon, and he's very close to the chairman of Exelon. What's his name?
John Rowe.
Yeah, the John Rowe. And he's one of his advisors. John Rowe is one of Obama's advisors. What sort of vice or cleft stick do you think that Obama is now caught in, Dave Kraft?
Well, it's clear that coming from the Chicago and the Illinois connection and having the United States' largest nuclear utility based here that was formerly Commonwealth Edison, which evolved into the Exelon Corporation, money talks. You know, we're not naive here. We in Illinois had a different take on Obama than I think the rest of the country when he was elected. You know, we had seen what he did and how he acted as a state legislator. We saw that his mentor was the president of the state Senate, who was really in the hip pocket of the nuclear utility here in Illinois. So we knew what the background was. We're also not stupid about campaign contributions.
Yeah.
And you're correct. The campaign did get about $250,000 through individual contributions of many of the Exelon board members, staff members, whatever. It was also pointed out during the election, and to be fair, by the Los Angeles Times, that Hillary Clinton also received a considerable amount of campaign contributions from East Coast nuclear vendors. So these guys know how to butter their bread. That's, you know, everybody's on the take, so to speak. Now, the reality, though, is that John Rowe in public has made many statements in the last 2 or 3 years saying that Exelon will not build nuclear anymore until the waste problem is resolved.
I see. Really? That's interesting. Yes. I didn't know that.
Yes. It's widely been reported in the trade press as well as the popular press. But the caveat to all this is he was just appointed as a participant in President Obama's and the Department of Energy's new Blue Ribbon Commission on America's Nuclear Future, which we refer to as BRC, the Blue Ribbon Commission. This is a panel that was supposed to address the radioactive waste problem after the administration pulled the plug on the Yucca Mountain project in Nevada. This was the only waste option that the government had going to figure out what to do permanently with the high-level waste. And quite frankly, we're all pleased that the administration did cancel this project. But this panel, which at least at first sounded like it was going to deal with radioactive waste, has been given a very, very wide latitude in terms of what it's going to study, what sorts of technologies it might take a look at. And we're very concerned, number one, that it is heavily stacked in favor of industry people and the pro-nuclear position. And secondly, their broadening of their mission really makes this look more like a whitewash of, we're going to have a nuclear future, folks, and this is what it's going to be, so that they can play the game that they have at least let the public participate, and this is their conclusion. So these are our concerns about the BRC, and John Rowe is a central figure in this, being a member of that commission.
I'm interviewing Dave Kraft, who's the founder of Nuclear Energy Information Service based in Chicago. But the other thing, of course, that concerns me, Dave, about this Blue Ribbon Commission is there are no biologists and there are no physicians on the panel. And if you're dealing with radioactive waste storage for the next 500,000 years, you have to deal with the health effects. So what they're doing is putting the health effects under the table, ignoring them, as they always do. And then if anyone talks about children getting leukemia and cancer and being born deformed, as they still are around Chernobyl, actually about 1 million people have died now because of Chernobyl, the people who bring up those subjects are labelled, quotes, emotional by the industry. So this, as you say, this panel is stacked, but by God, it's a really, it's apart from being a whitewash, it's really scary.
Yeah, you've hit the nail on the head, and we'll get into some detail of discussion about this in our conversation here. Obviously, the health fields have been totally eliminated from this panel. You know, it's sort of a perverse version of that old joke about the elephant being soft and mushy. It depends on, you know, how you define it. A problem is how you after it, and clearly, this administration wants to keep it within the techno-geek realm, or they can control the dialogue with the health, we know, with the physicists and the utility people. But you're absolutely correct. You know, the health professions are absent, and many organizations have been pointing out that the people who have borne the brunt of the last 50 years of the nuclear age in this country, the communities around the waste dumps that are leaking, we know they are leaking, around the failed reprocessing facilities in West Valley, New York, and in here in Illinois, we also have a failed reprocessing facility at Morris. These communities are totally absent from any kind of meaningful participation. Now, you would think a government would have wanted to know what failed last time in terms of involving the public, but apparently this administration is not very concerned with that. So that is another segment of the population that's been excluded from the official dialogue at this point.
Well, not only the victims, but there's a huge literature now on radioactive waste. And really, the most stunning recent document comes from the New York Academy of Sciences, which is just translated, or they haven't, but 5,000 medical papers from Russia, Belarus, and the Ukraine have been translated into English. And it's now documented that really almost 1 million people have died from Chernobyl, from cancer, leukemia. There are homes full of grossly deformed children that we pediatricians have never seen before. And to ignore this is, it's more than just a conspiracy theory. It's a true conspiracy. And I wonder who was responsible for appointing the people in this Blue Ribbon Commission, Dave Kraft? Was it Stephen Chu, who is the Secretary of Energy and totally pro-nuclear? Was it John Holdren, who supports Generation 4 reactors, the most dangerous machines ever contrived by man? Or who do you think decided who would be on the commission?
Well, I could only speculate on that, but I do think you've at least mentioned the two most logical candidates for starters. There may have been also some of the insiders within the White House staff itself who had input into this. In the early going of the administration, we had heard and picked up vibes that there was a tension going on between the White House staff on the one hand, for example, and Stephen Chu, the director, the Nobel laureate of the Department of Energy. Apparently, that conflict is no longer there, if it ever existed at all. And now it does seem that the administration is taking a much more vocal and public pro-nuclear stance. One of the most ghastly things I'd seen out of the administration was the 2010 State of the Union address by President Obama, which I think bears a little description here. It was supposed to be about how the United States needs a new green, sustainable economy. Because, of course, our economy is in the toilet right now, and we need everything to get the jobs up is the point he's making. Then he went on in this statement that this green economy was going to be based on, are you ready for this? I hope you're sitting down.
I'm sitting down.
Good. Clean coal, selective drilling, offshore drilling in the Gulf and along the coast, and clean, safe nuclear power. If you actually do a search of the document of the State of the Union address, you'll find that I think the word solar is mentioned twice, the word wind is not mentioned at all, and the word nuclear comes up quite frequently. So our green, sustainable economy, in the Obama administration's interpretation, is going to be built on an industry that had a catastrophic accident at a coal mine in West Virginia no more than 6 weeks after the State of the Union. That was the Massey Mine Corporation, where it was revealed that there was incredible corruption going on between the regulators and the mine operators. And then 6 weeks after that, 2 days before Earth Day this year, they blow up the rig in the Gulf of Mexico. So much for the clean, safe drilling in the Gulf. That's two down and one to go in terms of the pillars for the clean green economy that the Obama administration is pushing. And quite frankly, if that third pillar goes, you know, we're talking devastation on the order of what? Chernobyl? Chelyabinsk? We don't know.
Obama, during the campaign, said that he's not in favor of nuclear power. He stated that and said that the wastes problem has to be solved, et cetera, et cetera. So, from your knowledge of him, Dave Kraft, when he was in the Senate in the state of Illinois and when he was a Senate representative in the federal government, didn't he seem to have the cojones? Didn't he seem to have very high standards morally, philosophically, and the like? Or do you think he's always been a compromiser?
It's a tough call. I can't confess to have tracked his state Senate record, you know, closely or intimately. But I will say this, and it's an anecdotal thing here. First time I had heard Senator Obama, and a state senator, that wasn't even his federal tenure yet, was at a rally, at a speech in Chicago, just before the Iraq invasion back in 2002. So this was the fall of 2001. And on that podium, I heard someone I had never heard before. I didn't know who it was, but I just stopped in my tracks and listened in a way that I was just absolutely taken by the words that were being spoken. And it was, you know, the senator from Illinois, Barack Obama. He blew Jesse Jackson off the stage in terms of his oratory that day. Now, that may not mean a lot to many of your listeners, but I want to mention that, you know, this kind of oratory, particularly in the Black community, where you have a skilled oratory coming out of the religious communities and the preachers and the movement, this is highly prized and it's very well honed. And for him to blow Jesse off the stage was a real phenomenon. And I thought at that time, wow, who is this guy? We got to get him up in higher office. So this was my perception. And you were right, during the presidential campaign, the then federal senator from the state of Illinois was really saying quite a few good things. Although he was portrayed as being favorable to nuclear, if you actually looked at the website for his campaign and even some of his public pronouncements, he attached four very, very high bars that nuclear had to overcome before he would be supportive of it. And that was a solution to the waste problem was certainly one of them. The proliferation issues were another. Safety and security he was very concerned about as well. And he wanted a much more transparent procedure for the public to be involved in the nuclear debate. So those were the four caveats that he attached to his support of nuclear. But then he overtly stated, look, I'm not really interested in nuclear. I'm much more interested in, I believe he said, solar and biofuels were the two that he was interested in. So you're right. During the campaign, we were getting a lot of positive vibes indicating that we finally had someone who got it, who really understood that 8 years of Bush-Cheney nonsense was finally behind us, and we were going to be moving forward on a sustainable energy program. But to tell you the truth, we really haven't seen much that we can point to of substance that indicates that that's where we're heading.
Well, he surrounded himself with pro-nuclear people, the wrong people. I mean, Rahm Emanuel worked, I think, with John Rowe and Exelon. Dave Axelrod, I think, was a PR person for Exelon. And then he's got Stephen Chu and John Holdren, who's his science advisor. Why the hell did he appoint these rabidly pro-nuclear people? It's just almost beyond me, except to say, well, you know, at Chicago, Illinois politics and the like. But I don't know why or how he's lost his way, Dave Kraft.
I wish I had an answer for that one, too, to tell you the truth. I don't think that it's hopeless that we will not be able to move him, but I think a lot is going to be riding on this next round of elections that take place this year for congressional candidates, because I think that'll give him an indication, it'll be a barometer of where the mindset of the public is. My concern, though, is that global warming is barely even mentioned anywhere anymore, and you know, during the Bush administration, this was a very prime, huge issue. It's off the radar screen. If issues of that magnitude, of planetary survival, can disappear within a year or two, then I fear that the public, which is being overwhelmed with catastrophes, are quickly going to forget about the Massey coal disaster. They're quickly going to forget about the Gulf incident, if BP can whitewash it somehow, and the government can convince everyone that they really got it under control. This is what I'm afraid of, is the short attention span of the public, and then the messages won't properly get conveyed to the administration. But even with that, I actually don't know that that will be enough anymore, because the administration, the president, is only one of the players in this dance. And Congress is certainly another player.
Well, really, the public is being socially engineered, if you will, by the corporations, about five or six of whom now totally own the US media and the public airwaves. So, and those corporations are run by their advertisers, and their advertisers don't want to make the public uncomfortable. And anyway, many of the advertisers support the nuclear industry. So we're between, again, a rock and a hard place. I'm interviewing Dave Kraft, who's the founder of the Nuclear Energy Information Service. So, Dave, let's move on to the extension of lifespans of nuclear power plants in America. How long were they designed to be safe? And what's the nuclear industry up to? And in what states is it operating in this area?
initial reactor licenses were given for 40 years by the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission, you know, when the initial plants were designed, built, and now are operating. Since then, in virtually all the states that have nuclear reactors going, the utilities have submitted requests and applications to the federal regulator to extend that license an additional 20 years. So now we're looking at reactors that can be online legally for 60 years instead of the 40 they were designed for. What concerned us during the early debates on this was the federal regulators, the NRC's willingness to engage in what was called generic rulemaking. To me, what it really boils down to is the industry gave the NRC a set of wish lists on certain issues that if you could have this theoretical plant that had theoretically solved a significant design problem, then you could somehow logically conclude that that issue had been addressed and that the industry knew what to do and it would apply to all the other plants that were actually in existence. That's sort of a thumbnail sketch of generic rulemaking. Once the agency ruled generically that a particular safety system had been examined and in their estimate could operate successfully an additional 20 years, then it was a done deal. It could
really?
Never be brought up again
really?
At any of the individual hearings.
That's amazing. I didn't know that. And explain what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is, Dave Kraft, and who funds it.
Sure. The federal NRC was a outgrowth of a previous agency in the federal government called the Atomic Energy Commission. And that commission had been established after World War II to, at first, oversee nuclear materials and projects and constructions in terms of secrecy, because we didn't want the dreaded commies to get our materials and knowledge. But eventually, it was given a dual task to both oversee and regulate these power plants as they were being designed in the early days, but also to promote them. So you have a conflict of interest just built into the plan right there, and that was finally dealt with in the 1970s, where they split the tasks into two different agencies. The regulatory agency, the one that was supposed to oversee the plants and guarantee public safety, became the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And the other promotional and developmental energy agency became IRDA, the Energy Research Development Agency, which later became the Department of Energy, as we know it, the DOE. So that's how these two agencies were created. Now, the federal NRC now has a budget, an annual budget, over $1 billion. And most of the money actually comes from fees assessed on a per-reactor basis to the nuclear industry. So it doesn't get the majority of its money from U.S. taxpayers, although I do believe there is some money that goes in from the taxpayer base. But it's mostly from nuclear utilities and fees. So the problem also with the NRC is, because this is a very specialized field, you have to go through lots of expensive specialized training to become an expert in it. And when you have gone that far, there are only two things you can do. You either work for the utilities or you work for agencies like the NRC. And when you've hit the career climb as far as you can go, then you go to the other one. So one of the things we've seen over the years is this revolving door between the utilities that actually build and promote nuclear and the regulators, the NRC. It's been a very serious institutional problem in our view, and we've seen it as high up as the five NRC commissioners themselves, where people on the commission leave the commission, and within months, they're hired by a nuclear utility do lobbying or development or whatever. So we've always, our view of the NRC is personally that it's totally worthless as a regulatory agency. Somebody should blow it up and start over from scratch because NRC stands for not really concerned.
Yes, I think you're right.
That has been our view. We see this time and again on virtually every safety-related debate, issue, whatever, that the NRC caves in to the industry.
Mm. Mm. Well, seeing it's funded by the industry to a large extent, I'm interviewing Dave Kraft, who's the founder of the Nuclear Energy Information Service based in Chicago. Now, Dave, I want you to go into the dangers of extending the lifespan of a nuclear reactor from 40 to 60 years beyond its safety limits. Explain to the audience what that actually means, Dave Kraft.
Sure. We've actually seen some very functional and scary incidents already as a result of this with some of the older reactors. Imagine that you own a 1958 Oldsmobile or whatever car you want to take. You know, you eventually, as a car owner, reach a point where you have to decide how much more money are you going to invest in this thing to keep it on the road. Well, the nuclear industry finds itself in the exact same parallel situation, except that their assets are worth billions of dollars. So they have these old, 58 Oldsmobile reactors, and they also have some fairly new Chevy Corvette reactors, the newer ones. But the point is that all of these reactors over time will experience the life cycle stresses from the radiation that is emitted in the core of the reactors, the vibrations from the machinery, the pumps, the water flowing, the metal degradation from acids and other kinds of materials in the water. This goes on day in, day out, 24/7, 365 times 40 at the present reactors. And now they've added another 20 years of that kind of materials abuse to the reactor. I would point out, because I didn't finish the conversation a moment ago, that there is a study group that the NRC and the industry has engaged in to actually go beyond an additional 20 years to 80 years.
What?
So this is being looked at as a study exercise within the industry and within the NRC to go up to 80 years for operating cycles for some of these reactors. So again, how many of you are running around in Model T Fords, and how much money are you willing to invest in that to keep that one on the road? Now, it sounds absurd. I know I'm exaggerating to get the point across, but we did have an incident here in Illinois at one of the older reactors called Quad Cities, which sits on the Mississippi River, between Illinois and the state of Iowa, where not too long ago, about 5-6 years back, the reactor had to shut itself down very rapidly. This was called a scram. They had to shut down real quick because sensors detected a problem. And when they shut the reactors down and started examining the problem, they found that somehow, from somewhere, from some component, metal parts had shaken themselves loose and had been flushed down the cooling system and were actually obstructing some of the pathways to the reactor. If you obstruct enough water from the reactor, it'll overheat and melt down, and that's one of the accidents that, of course, is most serious and you want to avoid. The conclusion of that was that it was excessive vibration in the plant that had caused this. And one of the factors involved is that not only are they allowing reactors to operate beyond the 40-year limit, they are actually doing what are called power uprates for these reactors, meaning that a reactor that initially might have been designed to put out 1,000 megawatts of power is now, by regulation, allowed to put out, let's say, 1,050 or 1,100 megawatts of power, putting more demands on the machinery, more stresses on the system. And it was the vibrations caused by that that shook loose some of these parts in the Quad Cities reactor. Fortunately, it did not result in a major accident. But the fact that they're already noticing this in the older generation of reactors is extremely worrisome when you tack on another 20 years to the same reactor's life and you've cranked up its demands by 30% or 10% or 15%. So it's the combination of these two that we believe is just unconscionable. To paraphrase one of the ex-NRC people who we admire here in Illinois, this is the kind of thinking that causes space shuttles to crash.
And the pipes, of course, the metal pipes become embrittled, that's the word, from years and years of neutron radiation, and they crack more easily. And, of course, when you pump the power levels up, they're much more likely to break with the excessive vibration. I love the illustration, I think, of Dave Lockbaum, who actually is a nuclear engineer and who now works for the Union of Concerned Scientists, but did work for the NRC for a while. He talks about the bathtub curve. Do you know about that, Dave?
By that title, so okay. I'll let you go on.
The bathtub curve applies both to humans and nuclear power plants. So in the first few months of life, a baby is vulnerable to getting meningitis or whooping cough or all sorts of things because their immune system hasn't been well developed at that stage and they need the antibodies from their mother's milk and the like and the like. During sort of late childhood and middle age, the person's life is relatively stable health-wise. And then towards the end of their life, and I'm now 72, your pipes get rusty. You know, you get arteriosclerosis, buildup of cholesterol and neutral fats in your vessels, and that leads to heart attacks and to strokes and the like, and all sorts of things start breaking down. The joints of your body, because you once played soccer and you have to have knee replacements and hip replacements and the like. Well, the same with a nuclear power plant. In the first few months of life, that's where all the kinks and the problems get sorted out. And interestingly, the two huge nuclear meltdowns the world has now experienced, Chernobyl and Three Mile Island, occurred in the first few months of their lives. Then reactors tend to operate okay during the next 20 or 30 years, and then they start experiencing the problems similar to a human body, where their pipes become embrittled, corroded, and crud builds up inside the pipes. They become extremely radioactive and the like. And I think that's a very good analogy to a nuclear power plant. And what really scares me, Dave, I mean, I remember when I set up a conference on nuclear power and children's health in Chicago, and Chicago being a very Catholic community, I contacted the Catholic Archbishop in Chicago, who was not Bernardine, he'd since died, and I said, would you support and encourage people to come to this conference? And we held it in a Catholic school. Well, the letters stayed there for a couple of, I don't know, weeks, and then I got on to his chief advisor, who said, well, the cardinal doesn't think he should become involved in this. So I said to the man, well, if there's a meltdown, the cardinal will be involved in it, dealing with millions of people in Chicago with acute radiation illness, with their hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death, and the like. Well, it didn't get me very far, but that's the truth. I mean, is it? Do you think it, Dave Kraft, a level of ignorance or willing ignorance that causes people like the Catholic Church not to become involved if they're concerned about right to life and the life of fetuses? They surely must be, and fetuses are very vulnerable to radiation anyway, and it'll cause spontaneous abortions left, right, and centre if there's a meltdown. Why do you think they're blocking it out?
Well, again, I can speculate, and I'll probably get in trouble for this, and I'm only speaking as an individual here. This is not an organizational position. I'm what I consider a recovering Catholic, meaning I went through Catholic school as a kid, and now I do not believe in the church or any of those religious things myself. But taking a step back and looking, I have to just point out that all the churches, the Catholic Church and any other church you want to name there, is number one, an institution, which means it's a system, it's a political animal, and it exists in a political reality. I mean, those popes in the Middle Ages weren't there to save souls as much as they were to gather gold, you know, from the Crusades. So, you know, we have to keep that in mind, that when we start dealing with these figureheads and folks like that, that we're also dealing politically. This is not just a matter of faith and morals anymore. I think you get a lot more of that at the local level. So, again, that's just my take on it. It was a great try. It made sense. And if any of those upper echelon religious figures of any religion had any direct pipeline to the hereafter, they would certainly be on board on this issue, because this is an issue that doesn't just exist now. It has a temporal factor, which goes many, many generations in the future as we alter the gene pool because of radiation.
Mm.
So I think you just hit up against a bit of Chicago politics on that one again, I'm afraid to say.
Yeah, I always think, you know, they pertain to follow in the steps of Jesus, but what would Jesus do? You know, if there is a meltdown, and I asked a nuclear engineer recently in America, what are the chances of a meltdown? And he said 1 in 10 in the next 10 years, and I hate to say it, but, you know, it could well be Chicago and Illinois and surrounding states that are affected. And by God, not only will that mean the end of nuclear power, but it'll mean the end of uranium mining, people losing billions of dollars, but more than that, millions of lives lost. And if you read my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, you'll see that a meltdown is just absolutely catastrophic, particularly in an area with a high population density like Chicago. Dave, I see that you support a carbon-free, nuclear-free policy. Would you like to explain how you got involved in that and where you get your data from and what you think of it?
Yes, very happy to on this one. Many people criticize my organization and others like it as being naysayers and NIMBYs and you know, just folks who are uppity and, you know, rebels who just say no to everything. And, you know, that's a very convenient straw man that the opposition sets up and then demolishes, but it has nothing to do with reality, because all of our organizations, we view ourselves as safe energy advocates first. And yes, we are anti-nuclear and very proud of it, very much in the way that someone would be an anti-Nazi if they saw the storm clouds coming over Europe once again. So we have not just been against nuclear power for 29 years. We have been in favor of a radically different approach to energy, which are based on the laws of thermodynamics and not on the laws of Congress or economics. In fact, I just recently in a presentation, it slipped out. I cautioned the audience. I was very exasperated that the idea of Congress is doing this energy bill and this legislation. And I said, yeah, but Congress can't repeal the laws of thermodynamics.
Mm.
And our energy systems are so out of kilter with the way the universe operates that they are designed to fail. I mean, what we do with energy is abusive. And in fact, it's even downright addictive. I'll come back to that point in a minute. But carbon-free, nuclear-free was the culmination of the work of Dr. Arjun Makajani, who is the president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And people can actually go online and see his book, Carbon-Free, Nuclear-Free, A Roadmap to U.S. Energy Policy, if they go to www.ieer.org. That's the acronym for the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. I believe you challenged Dr. Makajani at one point to determine.
Yeah, I actually commissioned the report and raised the money for him.
And I'm glad you brought it up because, you know, this guy is a scientist. He goes with the numbers, and I have seen him take to task a number of our colleagues who, let's say, are a little too loose with the facts sometimes and, you know, really get caught up in effect rather than the data. And Dr. Makajani stays with the numbers. He stays within the data. And he convinced himself that we can get off of nuclear and we can get off of fossil fuels at the same time, cost effectively, by the year 2050. This, to us, was a breath of fresh air because somebody finally put it in a package that you could take around and show people and say, look, the numbers are done, folks, and whatever has already happened must be possible, because a lot of it was already being done.
Mm.
I would point out Dr. Makajani was wrong about this, though. He said we could do it by 2050 initially, and then because of technological improvements and developments and things that have moved forward in the last 3 years, he now says we can do it by 2040. So I sure would like to be wrong like that more often myself. So for us, carbon-free, nuclear-free is the pillar of the way we need to move forward on energy, not just in this country, but planet-wide. It takes the best of the sustainable puts them in play in a synergistic way, unlike the way we do it now. And it makes energy and efficiency and sustainability the purpose of energy systems, not shareholder value, which is what the current energy system does. So carbon-free, nuclear-free is a welcome choice on our end, and we have been actively promoting it up and down every energy fair we go to here in Illinois and in Wisconsin and everywhere else. We sing the praises of this, and we ask people to analyze it. We don't ask them to accept it. We ask them to analyze it and show us what's wrong with it. And we haven't had any takers yet. So we would encourage people to definitely on their own do the homework, go to his website, get the materials, find the flaws, feed it back to him, because he's certainly willing to reanalyze based on what you show him. But so far, so good. This is a program which could get us off of nuclear and fossils and all the hazards that are attached to it.
I call it a prescription for survival, really, as a physician.
Good point.
We really need to promote it enormously. I don't know if Obama's seen a copy. What I'm trying to do, Dave, is try and get half an hour alone with Obama, as I got an hour and a quarter alone with Ronald Reagan. Now, Obama is obviously by orders of magnitude more intelligent than Reagan was. When I saw Reagan, I think he had impending Alzheimer's, and actually I think that diagnosis was accurate. But Obama, having two little girls he adores, and is a very moral, upstanding, intelligent man. If I had half an hour with him, I could explain to him the medical dangers of nuclear power, including proliferation of weapons, which he obviously understands. And we might be able to change the course of history. Now, you're from Chicago. I've had a couple of near misses, i.e. nearly got in to see him or Valerie Jarrett and his advisors, but it hasn't worked out yet. If someone could get me half an hour with the president, I'd fly over from Australia at my own expense just for that half an hour. So I'm just putting this out, and I would take another physician with me so that I wasn't alone, that two physicians would present this data to him.
Well, we would certainly be willing to help you if we can facilitate this in some way. So I'm glad that that you're pursuing this one.
Yeah. Thanks, Dave.
As a pediatrician, as a doctor, your concerns have been about health effects, and rightly so. There are many other ways of attacking nuclear because, quite frankly, it has no positive attributes except it does produce greenhouse gas at the source of electricity. But I want to go back to something you mentioned very early on about emotions, because my previous lifetime was doing 12 years of clinical mental health in an impoverished area in Chicago called Uptown, which became a psychiatric ghetto in the 1960s when the state institutions started pumping people with Thorazine and thinking it was a cure. And then they dumped them all, 20,000 of them, into Chicago to fend for themselves.
Oh.
And I learned a lot in that lifetime. But one of the things that I really want to go back to is this issue of emotionality. There's always a negative connotation given when it's used, especially at these hearings that we all go to about, oh, you're being emotional. And I'd like to reassure all your listeners that you damn well better be emotional about this for a number of reasons. First of all, having emotion is humanly healthy. The lack of emotion is mental illness. You do not operate just from your head to begin with. Your emotions are essential survival mechanisms. And if you're picking up on something at the emotional level, even if you don't understand what it is, that's probably good. If you ignore that, if you were a species, you would go extinct very soon. So I want to underscore the value of emotions in this debate, in this issue, and in many others as well, that they serve a very functional psychological and survival mechanism. So this is healthy. And the second piece is that no decision is made by a human being without an emotional component. You cannot decide anything unless emotions are involved. So if we're going to decide rationally what is the best energy choice for our planet, emotions have to play a role in that. And to rip them out and to denigrate them and to say we have to just go by the facts, opens us up to very, very unhealthy situations at the best. So this issue of emotionality, I love it when they come up to me at some of these meetings and saying we're being emotional, because from my standpoint, they're feeding into my strength, and I can tell them, if you're not emotional, there's a serious problem.
I'm really glad that you do that, Dave, because I say to them, you know, if I have two parents in my office that and I've told them their child has cystic fibrosis or leukemia, and they show no emotional response, I get them a psychiatrist immediately because they need help. And so
that's right.
I would classify these characters who are all pro-nuclear, so ardently pro-nuclear, they need help. I think some of them have Asperger's and are not really very much in touch with their emotions. Others are practicing psychic numbing and denying what they really feel. If there is a meltdown, well, that's when they really will get in touch with their emotions. Now, Dave, you've just held a National Citizens Summit and Forum on Radioactive Waste Policy. We only have about how many more minutes? 5 more minutes. In that short space of time, can you just briefly summarize what conclusions were drawn at that the end of that conference, Dave?
Sure. When the Department of Energy created this Blue Ribbon Commission that we talked about earlier in the show, a lot of us were extremely dissatisfied, and you and I just went over some of the dissatisfactions. You know, they left out the health issues, they left out the community issues, they left out the people, they left out the emotions. Well, normally, in the past, groups would just passively take that, and then they would do their best and show up at the hearings and try and get public time. And we decided, this has got to be different. We're just tired of playing that game on their turf anymore. Uh-huh. We're going to create a commission from the citizens' viewpoint, and we are going to create our own body of documentation and our own positions on what should be done with radioactive waste. And it's going to exist whether they like it or not. They can incorporate it as part of their record if they choose to, or we will show them for the fraud that they are if they fail to do so in the future. So we are commissioning, well, we sort of colloquially call it a GRC. It's a Green Ribbon Commission. And it's going to take different forms, but we want to get our point of view across on what should be done with radioactive waste. And the very first point we want to make is observe the first principle of waste management, stop making it.
Yeah.
So from there, then we can talk about the other things of what should we do with the 50,000 tons that we've already created. So this the summit was a convening of over 80 individuals from 26 states, Australia, Canada, 3 First Nations tribes, to talk about what is our view of what should be done with the radioactive waste.
And are you going to put a document together to advise the government? And so you can really infiltrate into this Blue Ribbon Commission, so-called, with your Green Ribbon Commission?
That's one of the game plans in mind. We're going to be having some planning meetings in the next several months about how to proceed next. We could formalize this in some way. We could hold regional hearings of our own if we choose, but we're definitely going to make some formal positions and documents, which will be submitted either into the record of the Blue Ribbon Commission, or we'll publish it on our own, and we'll force the administration and others to deal with it, because it will be there.
Well, what you also need, obviously, is high-level media exposure. Have you thought about that, how to get on to the Colbert program or the Stewart program or who's that one, Rachel Maddow or Keith Oberman? I mean, we really need to get up there and start educating the masses, Dave Kraft.
Yeah, we certainly have to deal with the media issue. I suppose we could do a whole show on this. I know
we could,
but you know, certainly the high-profile people you mentioned are one avenue. But I would also say that it's time that we do with media, like we're doing with radioactive waste. If they're not going to give us the time that we need and interpret things the way we need it to be interpreted, then darn it, we have to create our own media, and it's already being done. We have the social networking factors that are in play now. We have the use of the internet video through YouTube and Blip TV and things like that. I understand you're putting together a new website, which heavily relies on blog contributions from folks like me and other folks that are dealing with these issues. If we have to go that route of inventing our own media, then we will. But there are other ways of intervening in media, which unfortunately we won't have time to get into today on the show here. But we'd be glad to talk to people offline or in other ways if they want to continue the dialogue.
Yeah, well, you've got to be inventive. I remember when a bill was going forward in Congress that was antithetical to the farmers. So hundreds of farmers brought hundreds of trucks packed with pigs and goats and sheep and cows, and they put them all on the steps of the Congress, and it made a dreadful mess, and it was on every TV station in the country. Now, that was clever, and they got their farm bill passed the way they wanted it. We've got to think of sort of classy, starry events that will attract the television, and they can't not report us, Dave. Have you got any ideas packed in your head about that?
Again, this is one of those topics we could go on and on about, but over the years I have pointed out to people that all stations, at least on the public sphere, not cable, but public, have licenses which come up for renewal. And one of the conditions for renewing that license is that they are serving their local community. And if people are fed up with not having things reported accurately or being excluded or blacklisted and not reported at all, they can go to those hearings or write letters and say, Station XYZ is not serving our local public needs, and we think their license should be revoked. Personally, I think that's where we ought to start, because that's like a kick to the cojones, a word you used earlier. That would really get the attention of the media that they have to do something radically different.
Look, Dave, I thank you very much for this interview today. You're one of the inspiring figures that keeps on going and keeps on going.
Thank you.
We're going to get there in the end, and I hope it's not going to be through a major catastrophic, life-destroying accident, but I mean, the way it's going at the moment, it may well be. Let's see if we can get to Obama, who's fundamentally a very good man, and let's see if we can turn the whole thing upside down.
Sounds good to me. People can contact us at Nuclear Energy Information Service by going to www.neis.org. That's our acronym.
Thanks, Dave. And also, if you want to go to my new website, it's called nuclearfreeplanet.org, and Dave will be blogging on that website, and we're going to automatically go to Twitter, Facebook, Dig, all the rest, so we can get to the younger generation. So thanks for listening all, and thanks, Dave, for your interview.
Thank you. Stay well.
My guest today on If You Love This Planet was Dave Kraft, the director and co-founder of the Nuclear Energy Information Service, a safe energy anti-nuclear group based in Chicago. Thanks for listening this week, and we'll be talking with you once again next week. Bye for now.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.